Okay, well, thank you very much to the organizers for giving me an opportunity to talk here. It's the first time I've come to Toronto, and this wonderful field, very impressive Fields Institute. And it's also very nice to participate in this workshop, and it's been very interesting for me to see that there's all this other part of this computational mathematics to do with the geometry and other sides, which which I'm not usually have a chance to hear talks on this topic, so it's very nice. So I know that means also there's some people in the audience who are not really in dynamics. So at least in the beginning, I will try to introduce things gently before I start my long 45-minute calculation. And then okay, so what's really one of the main objects of dynamical systems? You have a manifold, you have a map on the manifold, and the goal is to describe the dynamics. You can't start more basic than that. So rather than go too much theoretically into this, let me just take a specific example. So this is just a very well-known diffeomorphism of R2 called the Henon map. It's a relatively simple, just a polynomial diffeomorphism of R2, and it has been very much studied since the 1970s when it was introduced by Henon. You can do some numerical calculations, and you tend to get this kind of picture. So you just take a point, and you iterate the map. This is a little bit squashed, actually, because it didn't fit in the picture properly, so it's it should be more square. But anyway, so what numerical, non-rigorous numerical calculations, where you just plug in a number and you iterate, is it seems that the orbit converges on this kind of shape, which actually, if you zoom in, seems to have a fractal structure. So if you zoom in these regions here, you see that there's many lines. There's like a what looks like a Cantor set of lines, right? So this looks like a very complicated fractal structure. So you can draw a million points, and you see this. And of course, one immediate fact of interest is that whichever starting point you choose in some neighborhood of this, if you take points far away in the plane, they tend to infinity. But there's some kind of region here, so that any point will actually give you the same picture, right? So this is the picture. So of course, the challenge is to really say, what does this picture correspond to? Because it could be that this picture is actually, it could be that there's a periodic orbit of very high period, and every point is just attracted to that periodic orbit. And this picture here, imagine, you could imagine a periodic orbit of period a million, or probably even much less than a million, could look like this, and it might be very hard to recognize it as a periodic orbit. Or instead of a periodic orbit, there could be actually a non-trivial set with some chaotic dynamics on it. And people have been struggling very much to try to say something about this. Now, my contentious, hopefully contentious, conjecture of today is that it is actually impossible to really answer this question. So I think I'm very brave to make this conjecture, not because it's such a daring conjecture, but because actually it's impossible to prove me correct. It is, however, possible to prove me incorrect, because it might be possible to establish this structure, right? So, for example, it might be possible that Warwick really refines his calculations and finds a periodic orbit, and finds this attracting periodic orbit. Although I think it's very unlikely. And on the other hand, if nobody does that, I don't know if that counts as this conjecture being proved. Maybe as time goes to infinity, and in the limit it's still not proved, then my conjecture is right, something like that. But anyway, the point is that there are some reasons for which we can argue that it's impossible. And I want to try to justify and explore more this this topic during this talk. So that's why I call it deciding the undecidable. We somehow need to make some meaningful statements about this. So what are the options? We don't want to give up completely, right? Just because it's impossible, it's not the end. I don't want this to be the end of my talk. Rather, I want to describe at least two possible approaches for dealing with this kind of situation. The first one I'm just going to spend a couple of slides on, and is what I call the probabilistic approach. So the philosophy of this probabilistic approach is that we look at a neighborhood of the map F, and we say, okay, in this neighborhood, there's a certain dynamical phenomena that occurs prevalently or typically or with some positive probability. And then in some sense, it then makes sense to say, okay, well then, even though we cannot describe that dynamics of that exact map, in some sense it has a high probability of sharing that property, because in this neighborhood, most maps have this property. You know, but we still do not solve the problem of that particular parameter, but still this is a very useful and interesting approach, and there has been some results. So for example, in one dimension, so the quadratic map, this is the same map that Warwick Tucker talked about, although it's a slightly different parameterization of this. There are these results precisely that Tucker talked about. So Carles, Simon Tachier already quite a while ago did a lot of computations on this, and more recently Tucker and Daniel Vilchak, is that how you pronounce it? Sorry, I don't know. And so what they did is they were able to identify explicitly 10% of the parameters in this region. So this is a smaller region of the parameter space that Warwick was talking about, but this is where all the interesting dynamics happen. And for this 10% of parameters, the dynamics is regular. So these are the parameters for which a decision has been made, right? So these have been described exactly in some ways what the dynamics is. But that leaves 90% of the parameters out, right? And for these 90% of the parameters, basically the conjecture that I made above for the Henan map basically applies to these 90% of the parameters. So if we choose one of these parameters, basically it's impossible to decide if it's a regular parameter or a stochastic parameter. I mean, there might be a few more by this calculation that they're doing. They leave it running, you know, maybe in 5 years we'll have an extra 0.1% of parameters that we've decided are regular, but basically there's some kind of intrinsic limitations to the computation that says that these parameters you just really cannot decide one way or another. So in some sense you need to give some probabilistic. So one probabilistic is like Warwick had this conjecture about what the overall proportion of regular parameters is, and of course on a global level that gives you just some probabilities. So if you choose one of these parameters and you know that there's a certain, you know what the total measure is, then there's for each one there's a certain probability that it's in, that it's either regular or stochastic or something else. A few years ago I did this study like from the other side with a colleague, young colleague Takahashi from Japan, and we looked at a very small interval of parameter values close to 2, and we showed that in this very small interval 98% are stochastic. Okay, so sorry, is this green? Oh, minus 5,000, sorry, yeah, of course. 10 to the minus 5,000. So this, of course, this is a very small number, and 90% is actually, as Warwick said, a gross underestimation for this particular parameter value. But nevertheless, what is interesting is the techniques that we used for this, which are completely different from these, in some sense complementary. So what we do here really is we look at this range of parameters and we have a formula for excluding parameters and for finding, in some sense, estimating the measure of the set of stochastic parameters. I should emphasize that the theorem that the set of stochastic parameters has positive measure for the quadratic family goes back to 1981. So it's essentially almost a classical theorem. But until 2006, there was no numbers associated to that. So what we did here is we did a quantitative version of these theorems. That there have been several versions of that since 1981, but always just existence theorems in some sense. Okay? No, at least, this is from below, at least 98% are stochastic in here. Yes, certainly much more than that. And what we're working with, also we've been discussing with Warwick, and I've been discussing with several other colleagues now, is to try to use these techniques to look at these 90% of parameters. So of course, you can improve this discussion of the probability much more if you're able to make this kind of estimates for very small intervals. So really the philosophy would be, okay, I'm interested in this particular interval, in this particular parameter, A star, okay? So what would be good is to take a very small neighborhood of this parameter, apply these kind of techniques that we do here, and then you get 98% of probability, and then in some sense you say, okay, well, this parameter has 98% of probability of being stochastic. So in some sense, from that point of view, the fact that we work with very small intervals is an advantage, right? This fact that it's very small comes from the, in some sense, it's a feature of these techniques, whereas the feature of the numerical techniques is that it cannot go too small in some sense. So it is quite natural to think that these two can approach the problem from two opposite sides and maybe somewhere in the middle. Yes, yes, but there's, again, that's not quantitative, so you don't know when. Yes, yes, yes. And maybe I should mention this, that when I first gave this talk in Kyoto a few years ago, I think I hadn't finished, and you were in the audience, and you said, ah, but come on, you, a physicist can do this in 5 minutes, they don't care. But you're saying that, you know, in some sense it's kind of obvious from the numerics. It's true that it's kind of obvious from the numerics that you get these results. But unfortunately, so I don't know if it was worth doing all the work. But now we have a kind of rigorous theorem. Anyway, let me move on. So for two dimensions, we can't even do this better. So for two dimensions, we look at this family here, which is called the Henon family. So notice that for A equals 1.4 and B equals 0.3, this is exactly the Henon map that I had above. But notice also that for B equals 0, then everything gets collapsed onto the horizontal axis, and therefore Y is always 0, and this is exactly the one-dimensional quadratic family that we had before. So this is a family of two-dimensional diffeomorphisms that kind of generalizes in some sense the quadratic family. The quadratic family is contained in here. This has also been an object of study, and for this there is also some similar results. For example, Zin Arai, who is also here, has done what is in some sense a version of what Warwick, Tucker and Wilczek did for the one-dimensional case, which is he identifies lots of regions in which the dynamics is regular. He has a two-dimensional computational structure to, I don't think he can come as, he can consider such small regions as well he can, but still, there's quite a lot of work, and this is quantitative. But that's it, really, as far as explicit quantitative work, that's it. So we only have, for the remaining parameters, we only have these abstract qualitative existence results. So we do know that only for sufficiently small b, the measure of stochastic parameters is positive, okay? So we know that there is positive probability. If you take B very small, there's a positive measure of A for which these are stochastic, but we don't know which ones they are, right? Outside this set that Zin Arai has found and so on. So it's very difficult to get quantitative estimates, although I don't think it's impossible. I think it should be a nice PhD project for a good student, and this is for small b though. Then of course the question is for not small b. For example, the Henon map that I put above is b does not count as small, 0.3 does not count as small, and so I would leave that as a postdoc project maybe. This is actually a kind of version of Benedict Carlson result for B relatively large like this. It's kind of in some sense considered out of our present technology at the moment, out of reach. But actually I don't think it's out of reach. I think it's just that this paper is so technical, and even though it's been around for almost 20 years, as a community we're still struggling to really fully understand all its ideas that are in there. And actually, I don't think we will see this in the next 5 years, but I think in the next 10 years we'll probably do that. And I think, in fact, the main obstruction for be small is to obtain a certain uniform hyperbolicity outside a critical neighborhood, for those of you who are a bit familiar with this. And I think by computational methods it might be possible to do that, and it might be possible to combine some computational methods with this classical argument to approach this level, something like this. So what you could do then is you could take the Hannon map and you could apply this probabilistic approach. So you could take a small interval of parameter values around the Hannon map and you could say something like this. But for the moment we don't have anything like that. So while we're waiting, what I would like to do is propose another approach, which is a new approach. It's not technically that complicated, but hopefully it's got some new ideas in it, which I call this the finite resolution approach. So what's the basic philosophy of this? The basic philosophy of this, in some sense, is that this dynamics that we're looking for happens at extremely small resolution, and if it's so small, why do we really care exactly what happens at that infinitesimal resolution, you know? If I say, I look at the picture of the Hannon map and I say, I cannot distinguish between a periodic attractor or a chaotic attractor, well then maybe I shouldn't really care to distinguish. At least as far as possible applications or as far as possible, interest that people might have from natural sciences or from engineering for dynamical systems, it might not be relevant, okay? So that doesn't mean I want to do something, that still means I want to prove some rigorous theorems. So the theorem we're going to prove, so this is joint work of myself with Pavel Pilarczyk, and it's the following. The Hannon map, which is this one that I wrote previously, is topologically mixing at all resolutions greater than 10 to the minus 5. So I'm going to explain what all these terms mean, but first I want to emphasize, of course, that this result really contains two results. So the first result is part of a general theory, which is say, what does this mean to say that a map satisfies some property at all resolutions greater than something? So this is where, in some sense, I think the idea comes here. And the second part is the actual application of this idea to the case of topological mixing, which I'm going to say later exactly what it is, and to the case of the Hannon map, right? So I think what's most interesting in some sense is the theory. So let me explain a little bit what the problem is and what the solution is. So let me describe, first of all, the context. So we have suppose we have a metric space and we have a map on this metric space. And we have a cover, an open cover of this metric space, and we have a multivalued map on this cover. And then we want somehow this multivalued map to be related to the dynamics. I hope you can see this, yes. So we say that F, so this is a finite cover, right? So F is a combinatorial representation of little f if we have this property. So you take an element of the cover U, right? And you want to make sure that the image of this element U, which is several elements of the cover, this is a multivalued map, contains all the elements that you get if you actually iterate this cover U by the original little map F, and then you see all the ones that it intersects. I should have drawn a picture for this, but actually it's really the obvious thing from the intuitive point of view, right? So you take U, an element of the cover, you apply the little map F, and you see what elements of the cover it intersects, right? And that's how you define the multivalued map here in the obvious way. So ideally you'd like this to be actually an equality, so you'd like to define the multivalued map exactly like this. But for rigorous computational reasons, of course, sometimes that's not possible to do, right? So we are satisfied with just the fact that at least it contains this representation, although in practice you want to be as essential as possible, right? So this is in some sense a way of describing the dynamics at a finite resolution. So we want to describe what happens as you kind of change the resolution. So a couple of technical definitions. What we mean by two covers, one cover being finer than the other, is just a very obvious definition, which is that U1, except that I got them wrong, of course. Yeah? So, sorry. So I was So U1 is finite in U2. If you have the element of U1, of course, it contains some element of U2, and every element of U2 contains some element of U1, so these two should be swapped. So this is the obvious definition. And then I also want to define what it means for the map, the combinatorial map, to be finer. This is also kind of obvious. So F1 is finer than F2 if it's defined on a cover which is finer than U2. And also, if you take any cover U1 and contained in some U2, okay, and then every element of the image of U1 is contained in some element of F2 of U2. It's just that obviously kind of one is contained in the other, right? This is finer. Because what I'm going to want to do is I'm going to want to use this to define scales, to study the map at different scales in some sense. Right, so now I want to kind of formulate my theory a little bit better. So suppose I have some statement for the original map. It could be that it's topological mixing, some kind of statement which might be true or might be false. And then suppose I have a statement that applies to combinatorial maps, and then what I want to define is this. I want to define the concept that this statement for the combinatorial maps is in some sense a finite resolution version of the statement for the map. So if I want to say whether, I want to ask whether the map little f is topologically mixing, I want some kind of statement for this. And what kind of statement do I want? So I want two important properties for this. I want, first of all, to make sure that this is computable. So I want this statement for the combinatorial map to be computable, because I'm going to want to compute this. This is how I'm going to want my theory. But secondly, I want it to be consistent with this one here. So I want to make sure that if this actually does hold, then this will always hold for every combinatorial representation of the map. And I also want this to be kind of monotone. So I want to see that if I check some combinatorial map and this holds, and I take any coarser one, it should also hold, right? Because I want to say, if I look at a very small scale and I prove something, it's true for all the larger scales. So these are the two properties that I want to make sure hold. So the first one is computability. I want to show that in finite time I can actually check. And the second one is consistency, which is what I just said. So if P holds for little f, then the finite resolution version holds for any combinatorial representation, big F. And if it holds for some combinatorial representation, then it holds for all the coarser ones. Okay, these are kind of natural conditions that I want. And an example is precisely topological mixing. So this is the definition of topological mixing, is that you have two open sets and the pre-image of one after some point intersects the other one. Okay, I want, if you know it, you know it. If you don't, it's not so important, the exact definition. This is a combinatorial mixing, which is just that if you have one of these covers and you take the pre-image of this multi-volume map, multi-valued map, basically it covers everything, okay? So this is fairly straightforward. But the point I want to emphasize here, that this is not enough, okay? So this looks like I'm done with the theory, but this would be a little bit too simple. So what this shows, once I find some finite resolution version, it says, okay, that's nice. So now I make an open cover of my system. I check that it satisfies this, okay? And then I tell you, okay, so my map is topologically mixing at all resolutions greater than this. But then you can go and you can do, you can use another open cover with covers of the same size, and you don't get the result, okay? Because notice that this says that it has to be just the finer. It holds for all the coarser combinatorial representations. So coarser means that you must use a cover that is related to the cover that I chose. And this is not satisfactory, right? I need to be able to formulate this definition where I tell you, okay, I have checked this property at all resolutions bigger than some epsilon, and you need to know what it means without me having to specify the actual cover that I chose, right? Yes. Yeah, this actually, we did notice this. And to be honest, we didn't really know how to formally resolve this. So, I mean, I guess you just need to choose one that makes sense. Yeah, but you're right. If you have a suggestion, I would like to hear it actually. in the end, we were just not able to get past that point. Okay, so I don't know if I've managed to communicate quite this point, right? Is that just these conditions, they tell me that if I choose a cover that is coarser, so the definition of finer and coarser depends on the specific cover that I choose, right? So this is not quite good enough, and this is in some sense the key idea, is maybe not such a profound idea, but the idea of our theory is to get around that. And to get around that, we need to be a little bit more subtle about the covers, and we need to define what we precisely mean by resolution. And for this, we're going to need to define two kinds of resolution, outer resolution and inner resolution. So the outer resolution is kind of the obvious thing, which is just the maximum size, the maximum diameter of the elements of the cover. And then we also define the maximum resolution of the map, right, which is basically comparable. I mean, this is the maximum diameter of the elements of the cover, and what this symbol means is that you take the image of the cover and you take the union of all the elements that intersect, of all the elements in the image, right? Now, if the original map has some bounded derivative or bounded Lipschitz constant, then this is basically just a constant times this one. So this doesn't make much difference. So this outer resolution is basically how big the elements of the cover is, right? So if you say epsilon outer resolution, all the covers, the diameter is smaller than epsilon. It turns out that the crucial, though, is this inner resolution, which we define as follows. So the inner resolution of a cover is the supremum radius, basically, such that if you take any point in your space, there's a cover that contains the ball of radius d centered in x. I'll draw a picture in a second. This is also known as the Lebesgue number of a cover, basically. Most of you will know that. It's the overlap, okay? In this case, we define the inner resolution of the map as just the same as the cover, okay? This is just a picture. Unfortunately, sorry, this picture has one other definition which I'm not going to use in this talk, but basically these U1, U2, U3, U4 are the elements of the cover. This is our plus. I'm sorry, I see I've made another mistake here because I've swapped the two symbols, plus and minus. Very sorry about that. But this is the outer resolution, and this is the inner resolution, which is this ball. It means any point you take has, if you look at the ball of size d around it, is contained in one element of the cover. Okay? So it says they're forced to overlap. Notice that if you took a partition, then this is zero for a partition, right? And this turns out to be a crucial aspect of the theory, that it will not work for partitions. We really need to have this positive number here, okay? And we have a theorem, right? So the theorem is the following. So suppose we have a property that's a finite resolution version of P, and suppose that this finite resolution version holds for a combinatorial representation of F0 of F without a resolution less than or equal to epsilon. That means as long as the size of the balls is less than or equal to epsilon, no other assumption, okay? Then what you can conclude is that it holds for any combinatorial representation with inner resolution at least epsilon. That means any cover, so clearly the covers, the balls of this cover, the elements of this cover have slightly bigger diameter, but not necessarily very big, but they must have overlaps. You know, they must have significant overlap so that every point has an epsilon ball that is containing a single element of the cover. So this allows us to make this definition, which says that the map, we say that this map satisfies P, which is like, say, the property related to the little map, at all resolutions greater than or equal to epsilon. If it satisfies P, where P is a finite resolution version of P, and I was about to write it as an appropriate finite resolution version of P in some sense, yes, that makes sense, for all combinatorial representations of F with inner resolution greater than or equal to epsilon. So the crucial point about this is that it is sufficient to check the property P for a single combinatorial representation with sufficiently small outer resolution, which is this, and it guarantees you that then any combinatorial representation with this property will work. So this solves the problem that I said before. So now I can tell you, okay, I've checked this property at every resolution bigger than epsilon, and I do not need to specify which cover I use, because as long as you use a cover that has inner resolution bigger than epsilon, you're guaranteed to get that same result, right? So the proof of this theorem is actually not very difficult at all. It's basically, we show that this implies that this cover is coarser than the other one, right? But the point is that you do not need a reference, I do not need to specify my original cover. Okay, that's the point. So that's right. So this is the abstract theorem. This is not specifically for topological mixing or any. This is a general property based on the definition of what we mean by finite resolution version of this property. So now we want to apply it to the Henon map. And so what we do, the first thing we need is two steps. First is to construct the combinatorial representation, and then to show that it has satisfied the combinatorial mixing, basically. So I'll just take you through the steps of the computation. So it's easy to see that there's a forward invariant rectangle, which is this, which you can actually prove analytically. And we just cover this region by small overlapping rectangles B. And then we choose a point x0 close to the attractor. For example, you could just run a non-rigorous simulation with an initial condition and you wait 1,000 iterates, and then it's very close to the attractor. And basically you just iterate. So this belongs to one of these elements of these rectangles, and then you look at the image of x0, and using, of course, rigorous interval arithmetic, you just take all the elements of the cover that intersect, you know, the image of x0, and then each of those elements you iterate again according with the map F, and then you choose all those that are intersected. You basically just keep going until you end up with some invariant set, right? So this is fairly easy to see that this is a finite process that will eventually stop, unless it's, you know, will generally stop. And so there's an actual algorithm for constructing the subset of B that you use to define your combinatorial representation, and then we just define this map F induced by the little map F on this combinatorial representation. So this is all fairly kind of a standard computation in dynamics. In our case, we just divided this big rectangle into these many little rectangles, because this was a number. So this process, you want this process to end up with a combinatorial map which has outer resolution less than 10 to the minus 5, which is what we wanted to prove. So this works, basically. And then we have a combinatorial map. It has the outer resolution less than 10 to the minus 5. And then we just need to show that it satisfies the combinatorial mixing. So for the combinatorial mixing, we represent this combinatorial map as a directed graph. It has a natural structure as a directed graph. And then there's a whole bunch of graph algorithms. Basically, you can interpret the definition of combinatorial mixing in terms of graphs. It turns out that the combinatorial map is combinatorially mixing if and only if this is equivalent to saying that the graph is strongly connected and aperiodic. That's fairly elementary to see that. And so we use a couple of algorithms here. We use Tarjan's algorithms to check strong connectedness. There's various algorithms, actually. So I guess it's one of the most basic concepts, is to check that graphs are strongly connected. But we wanted one that worked in linear time, I will say later. So they have various efficiencies. And then, actually, for the aperiodicity, we use an algorithm that's on Wikipedia. And it doesn't have any reference, actually, as to where this algorithm comes from, or any name, or anything like that. But it's We've got a proof of the fact that this algorithm works, and it works in linear time. There's no proof in Wikipedia, but it's not complicated.
What is aperiodic?
Aperiodic means that it doesn't. There's no cycles in there. Basically, it's. What's the formal definition for a graph that's aperiodic? At the moment, I have a blank. That's right, that there's some finite time from which you can get from one place to any other place. Yeah, there's a finite time after which all the entries are one. Yes, thank you. Yeah. Because if you just have strong connectedness, that is some kind of transitivity. But mixing is some kind of aperiodicity, so something like that. So both of these algorithms are in linear time, which we kind of wanted that to do. So just combining all these things, I just want to state again our theorem, now that we understand a little bit better the meaning of this. Again, I guess there's two kind of justifications for a theorem of this kind. One justification is simply that we cannot do any better. In other words, we just cannot say what the dynamic. We have no other way to make any other rigorous statement, really, about the Hanon map for this specific parameter value, so we just do the best we can. And the other one is that, after all, maybe for applications, or there might be reasons in which this is enough. You know, we've given a rigorous formal meaning to exactly what this means. So anybody can actually take a cover, you know, within a resolution bigger than epsilon and replicate this property. So a few final remarks about the computer. This actually does not mean that much to me, but this is the computer that we use. So Pavel was the main computational guy in this project. I presume this is not necessarily such a hot computer, but so the computation time for this took about 77 minutes, although interestingly most of it was for the construction of the combinatorial map, right? And the algorithm took about 6 minutes. So I discussed with Pavel why can we not go down to 10^-6 if it only takes 6 minutes? From what I understand, especially from the graph algorithm, the problem is that the whole graph has to be in the memory of the computer. And so the main is not so much the time, but the main obstruction is just to get this whole graph in the memory of this computer. So he made some estimations of what it would take to go deeper, and with the same kind of technology, to achieve 10^-6 resolution, we take 26 hours and 186 gigabytes of memory, and to go down to 10^-7, maybe 500 hours and 3.7 terabytes. But I mean, maybe there's ways to get around that. I know, speaking to various computational people here, they use many computers simultaneously or whatever, you know. So maybe there's ways to get around this. But yes, so also the software, the code is all, you can download it, it's all freely available on Pavel's website. So all the code for this is there. So, okay. So I think I'll finish. Thank you very much. Well, that already has fine. That's a good question. It could look mixing. That's right. So that's an interesting point. So of course there's an asymmetry in this definition of the finite resolution property, is that if not every property works in this sense, right? So the property that we want, that it's if you have a positive answer for the infinite scale, you should have positive answers for all the finite scales, right? So for topological mixing, the way we've set it up is that if the map is topological mixing, then at every finite resolution it will also look mixing, right? But of course you cannot, but if it has a periodic orbit, it can still look mixing at finite resolution. But that's exactly the source, that is why this problem is difficult, right? That's the original problem, is that we cannot distinguish. It looks mixing. If you just do non-rigorous numerics on the map, it looks mixing, right?
It doesn't look like you have a periodic orbit.
But it might do.
But the question is, it doesn't follow from your theorem, but if periodic orbit exists, then the period is larger than a certain number.
Ah, is that what you meant? No, but that's a good question. Yes. Yeah, that's a good question. That's a good question. I haven't thought about that. But yeah, probably. It means maybe depending on the yeah, you probably could deduce that, right? Because it says somehow that the immediate basin of attraction of the orbits has to be smaller than something. Yeah, yeah. That's a good question. Yes.
So one way to link your P and your calligraphic P a little bit more is to say that calligraphic P holds a smaller resolution than P holds for F, right? So you only have a sort of one-way thing.
That's right. Oh, if calligraphy P holds at all, that's a good idea. That's a good idea.
And that could also say what kinds of P are possible, and maybe periodic orbit isn't possible to have.
That's a really good idea. Yeah, I don't know how difficult it would be to prove in this case, for example, that if it holds it. That's a really nice, really good idea. Thank you, yeah. Yeah.
So if your real map F satisfies the mixing property, it should be verified.
Yes, that's intrinsic. That we've proved. So that is part of the requirement that we have, that if the real map is mixing, the finite resolution will be mixing at every resolution.
No, but can you verify that?
Yes. Maybe I don't understand your question.
Maybe.
Yes. No, this is part of our calculations, but it's not so difficult. So we have it. It's part of the lemmas that we've got to show him that all this makes sense, is that this property defines this consistency condition at all scales. So that means if the original map is mixing, then the finite resolution version will always be mixing, and the computability condition says that you can actually verify it in finite time at every scale, because... Yes, we not only show that it is, but we actually found an explicit algorithm that we use to show that, yes. That's right. So in that's exactly the theorem that we've got in that direction. But the other direction, I think, is really interesting. Yeah, that would be a way to say that the calligraphic P is the right one. Yes.
Is there any way to optimize this with the multi-resolution cover? Like, big square is far away from the attractor, and
you mean for the time, for the computation on all time? I don't know if it would help, yeah. I'm not so sure, but yeah. That's definitely worth trying in general, yeah. Yes, in this case we use a cover that's all the same size. We divide into equal bits and we use that. It's true that the dynamics is very non-uniform. For example, for similar project that I did with together with also Pavel and some other people in one-dimensional dynamics to calculate the resolution outside the critical point, we noticed that if you use a non-uniform partition and you make them small in certain region, you get much better estimates, yeah, quicker in some sense, yes. Yeah. So that would be an interesting thing to try. Although, from what I understand now, this main problem is this graph having to fit into the, you know, the number of elements that you choose, because this has to fit into the computer memory. So I don't know if that would help very much. Yeah.
These estimates of type, these graphs you're getting, your matrices, for example, they're rather sparse.
Yes.
So you're using this anyway already. Of course, you need huge memory so you take it as a...
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, we certainly notice that they're rather sparse. I don't know if this plays, you know, any...
If,
Yes, no, I think we use algorithms that work better for sparse matrices, yeah. Because you do this depth first search thing, and you know, we use algorithms that work better in that case, yeah.
When you take this resolution, you say 10 to minus 5, are you taking, say, square pixels or something like that, or you try to adapt this covering to the shape of the dynamics?
That's right. That's a similar question to that. No, for the moment, we just took rectangles.
Because if you try to, at least in some places, to take, say, some kind of curved rectangles close to the stable manifold of the hyperbolic fixed point, this will help a lot.
It could reduce the number of elements of the covering.
Number,
No, you mean the growth in the number of the rectangles is non-linear in terms of the... Oh, I don't know. I didn't... I guess it's related to the kind of Hausdorff dimension of the... It's in some sense it's related to the dimension of the attractor, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, as usual in these things, if you're trying to cover an attractor that has fractal dimension, so probably you get this... you're very...
Maybe the square of the Hausdorff dimension.
Well, if there are no further questions, then let's thank our speaker.
Thank you very much. Very good. Thank you. Thank you.
I'll talk something. I remember the secure the thing. Yeah?
You
I'll tell you what I thought about it.
No, that's
the argument. Okay. I mean, the argument is that there is a set of theoretical knowledge in one dimensional case, which is not available in North, which is much harder.
Sure.
Another dimensional that you have either one behavior or another, and the rest has zero mesh. So the parameter
space.
Either it's periodic,
sure.
Or it has a critical tension, or the rest has zero mesh.
That's right.
To estimate the measure, you just have to deal with only one type of behavior, it's periodic cortex,
which
is, of course, easier. And then if you have a certain control on how big for large Q, for large period of Q, that the length of Modlock interval cannot be too long, then
that's
you
right.
have some truth.
That's
but
here
in the coin, no, it's much harder.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
don't
yeah.
have it at
all. Exactly.
It's much harder problem.
Yes, let me take it.
You're using a computer, right?
I am a computer, yes.
My question
is that...
thank you. I hope we might find some other applications of that. You know, now it's kind of a test case, and let's see what...
Does this come from, or the framework come from anywhere? I mean, it looks...
There's
some things that are in.
Let me just
I can't even remember.
What do you mean by the framework?
Well, when you set up the combinatorial map and so forth.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I mean this is a standard way of just approximating the dynamics, right, by a finite thing. So you you kind of covered. Many people try to put partitions, and you know, so you cover it with different degrees of success or different degrees of really usefulness as to what you actually get out of it. You know, but it's natural to just take a cover and look at how this the map acts on this cover.
Yeah.
You know. So I don't know exactly what specifically you're referring to.
There are computer science people who are theoretical computer science people who are concerned about uniform.
To see what
that kind of thing is when you consider counter and line resolution with a single program. It's not a practical, well, not immediately a practical.
Sorry, what happens is what? Say again.
If you try to compute things, if say you want to run a program which will in this particular example, and it's clear what you do, I guess, from what you've said, that the theoretical computer science people, when they're interested in generally, if you don't have, you wouldn't have the Euclidean structure on the space.
Okay.
You want to know general topological arguments which will let you ensure that things will work finally. That's not really explaining it. I just meant how well does this point is it compared to some other finite resolution or
I don't know how it's fitting with anything else, actually. But, yes.
I don't quite follow your answer, so I'm not quite sure I understand what you mean. So my question is, okay, suppose you know that the map is topological and makes sense.
Yeah.
And suppose the map is also computable in the sense that you can approximate the dynamics of any desired finite precision.
With a single program.
So, for example,
with a single program.
Yes.
You don't fix
with a single program.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know otherwise how to make sense out of it. So
I don't know exactly understand what that means.
Yeah. So something like this.
Yeah.
Maybe you have an explicit formula. Maybe you have an explicit algorithm.
Yes, exactly. For the Hanon map.
Up to given
that.
Epsilon.
Sure. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Now suppose you know that your map is mixing.
Yes.
Is it true that you can verify epsilon mixin for every epsilon?
Yes.
Why is that true?